since 1960, or if you went back to probably the mid-50s, we've essentially tripled in population over the last, 65, 70 years. Well, we've added as many people globally since 1994 as we're ever expecting to add from now on, which I think is while it's maybe a lot of people are aware of it, I think the implications on labor markets and even capital markets is definitely underappreciated.
I'm pleased to introduce Brett Swango to the Office Space Podcast. Brett is the head of location intelligence and workforce analytics at Colliers. His team helps our clients with workforce-related insights to make quantifiably justifiable located-related decisions in labor markets around the world. When clients ask questions like, what's the best place to open an office or facility for my business? I call Brett. He's been on the program before discussing labor trends. In this episode, we have a more general conversation on how the interest rate increases will be affecting labor and real estate. But when talking with Brad, it's fun to see where the conversation goes, so we end up covering other topics as well. I hope you enjoy.
Brett, welcome to the program.
Appreciate you having me, Dougal.
So we're going to cover a few different things here. It's always great having you on. As I mentioned before, the last podcast we had with you talking about the labor markets and the migration was our most downloadable podcast. So you're clearly a valuable resource to the listeners out there. So let's start off. I want to talk about capital markets a little bit and what the interest rate hikes have done and the trickle effect on that. And then we're going to kind of go from there. So can you talk a little bit about the capital markets, the state of the capital markets right now, and some of the effects it's had, looking at the different things like labor and things of that nature?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think starting at a super macro level, everybody knows this, but we've been in kind of a 40-year bull market, right, for treasuries. So the cost of capital has continuously been going down. And what that does, for all the analysts on the call who are running NPVs, as that interest rate comes down, it increases the value of future cash flows. So what is that? Who is that benefit historically inured to? It's whether it's tech or life science, when interest rates are zero and your future cash flows, when your future cash flows are basically valued the same as your nominal cash flows, because again, your discount rate to make an extreme point or to make an extreme statement to make a point. When your interest rate's zero, a dollar of cash flow in year 40 is worth the same as a dollar of cash flow today. Right. So the problem is, it was Warren Buffett or somebody said the eighth wonder of the world is compound interest. Well, the problem is when interest rates go up, it's that compound interest has the exact opposite effect of an investment when you're running that NPV from a discount rate perspective, saying what is the value of those future cash flows. So what we've seen is that specifically in tech and life science and these organizations that have been historically valued based on growth, their valuations have been hit disproportionately as we've gone through the most aggressive rate hike cycle, I think in history, definitely in the last 40 years, with 475 basis point increases. And the latest news is that that's supposed to slow down. And certainly that should help provide some level of stability to the market. But the narrative in the commercial real estate world is a lot of, on the industrial side is, hey, we can no longer make the numbers work with the cost of debt for this development deal. Or on the office side of, hey, we got to refinance this building and we did this in 2012 and now our cost of capital is, doubling or tripling along with vacancy. That's causing a big challenge. Well, that's kind of, I think what we're hearing most of, but I think if you look at the user side of the equation and ultimately what valuations are doing and what cost of capital is doing and the knock-on effects regarding some of the layoffs that you've seen on the tech side, I think that's largely attributed to, this current interest rate environment. So that's kind of the macro of the capital market side. And then what does that mean, for the labor market is, if you look 24 months ago and even as recently as 12 months ago, I was looking at an article from April, actually, and it talked about, I think Amazon's plans to hire something 55,000, tech and IT and analytics professionals globally. And then at the same time, Facebook had plans to add another 10,000. And then you look in the headlines, 7 or 8 months later, and these are the groups who are making massive cuts. Well, we went through this big bulge of digital transformation that took place during COVID when every company was forced to become a tech company. And the most in-demand skill sets across the spectrum were these highly technical individuals. Well, now the industries that they're disproportionately dense in, as I mentioned, specifically tech and IT and any other high kind of growth organizations, their valuations have really been cut. And even if you look at what Andreessen and Horowitz and other VCs are telling their portfolio companies is saying, hey, you know, buckle up. It's going to be a really bumpy ride. And a lot of the CEOs of these tech organizations have never been in a, you know, it's been a 10 or 12 year bull market for growth stocks versus value, i.e. you're being valued based on your top line and not your bottom line. And now all of a sudden they're being told, hey, we need to get to profitability as soon as possible because, you know, those cash flows that weren't going to start for 10 years, but were going to look great from your growth perspective, those are no longer worth anywhere near what they were 8 months ago when interest rates were, you know, a third of what they are today.
Yeah, and especially...
So I think that's an interesting... Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah, no, I was going to say, especially, you know, in the life cycle of some of these funds where there are a lot of private equity backed companies, and if they're coming in a 5 or 6 year period, it's one of those challenges, right? In the framework of that time period. So
it's a really, really good point regarding the, I guess, again, the, I'll call it the intricacies of the capital markets and whether that's on the, hey, you're actually investing in operating companies or you're investing in, you know, conversely on the real estate side. I think those are massive implications when you see the rate of change and the cost of capital that we've seen over the last 8 months.
Right. I'm hearing from some private equity companies that were normally investing in, you know, some higher multiple type companies. They're willing to invest in lower multiple companies, but there's a viable, you know, ongoing concern. And it's not a growth story so much as maybe more of a value story.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's what, again, when you've got the, and I jumped right into some pretty deep topic there to come out of the gates. But yeah, the punchline of that is when interest rates are high, positive cash flow sooner is disproportionately valuable relative to growth and, you know, future cash flows. And we're hearing that from a lot of our private equity clients as well.
Right. And so, you know, we still have this push-pull from the employer to the employee. There seems to be a bit of a shift in favor of the employer in the labor market right now. Do you, you know, what kind of effects is that having? And is it a little too early to tell? And it's not just all tech companies either. It's kind of across the board, but it seems that the tech companies are being affected the most because they have the growth story that's not playing out maybe so much right now. What are you seeing on the labor side?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's consistent. I mean, we're still in, you know, we're kind of in a chronic, or the terminology I've used, and I may well end up eating my words at some point here, but if you look at the numbers, we're in a chronic labor shortage. You know, assuming that we're in some type of stable economic environment, right? If, you know, if the bottom falls out of the economy and we go into a deep recession, obviously there's going to be an excess supply of labor. But, you know, there's 300,000 less people turning 18, you know, this year than there were 10 years ago. I think I talked about this last time, but I was kind of peaking that millennial segment, right? We're the largest cohort. And, you know, when we're all coming into the workforce, that's a deflationary component because you got disproportionate supply relative to demand. Well, there's actually, I've used this in some other presentations, but they call it the 60-20 ratio. It's basically like, what's their, or 20-60, what's the ratio of the number of 20-somethings relative to the number of 60-somethings? And that's a very good predictor, obviously, of the growth of the labor force because, you know, the 60-somethings are the ones that are moving out, you know, they're carouseling out of the labor pool, and the 20-somethings are the ones moving in. Well, you know, you go back into the 70s and 80s, there was like 120% more 20-somethings than there were 60-somethings. You move that to today, and you're at like 10 to 15%, and we're quickly approaching equilibrium. There were actually more people born in the United States between 52 and 61 than there were between 92 and 01. So if you look at that, you know, the demographic, and we're in a much better spot than Europe, even Europe is in a much better spot than, like, you know, China and even Russia. Those are two of the worst demographically positioned countries. But, you know, I just posted something on LinkedIn recently looking at, you know, since 1960, or if you went back to probably the mid 50s, we've essentially tripled in population over the last, like, you know, 65, 70 years. Well, we've added as many people globally since 1994 as we're ever expecting to add from now on, which I think is, like, while it's maybe a lot of people are aware of it, I think the implications on labor markets and even capital markets is definitely underappreciated. And if you take out Africa, we're actually, like, we're peak population now. Like, we're actually going to be declining essentially from now on in the, you know, call it the developed world. So the punchline with all that is that while, you know, there's still over, what is it, like 1.7, 1.8 job openings for every unemployed individual. I'm looking forward to seeing that number here in a few days to see what that ratio, how that's changing with some of these most recently announced tech layoffs. But while it's starting to lean more employer favorable, we're still in an employees market for now.
Right. Yeah, it'll be interesting. How often are those numbers coming out?
Monthly.
Monthly. Okay.
You know, yeah, it's a monthly number.
Speaking about some of those layoffs in the tech world, I had a client recently who, you know, had a fairly sizable office in a major market, and it was being utilized 5% of the total employees that were there. Only 5% were using it on a weekly basis. So it was an easy decision for the CFO to say, you know, we're just going to cut that out. They were coming up on a lease expiration. So we started looking at flex options. They announced to the employees in that market, we are no longer going to have an office. Suddenly there was a flurry of emails and conversations about, wait a second, I was planning on coming in after the first of the new year. Wait a second, I was going to have meetings. I was. I think there's a little bit of a psychology effect associated with having a physical presence in a market tied in with, you know, the shift in the labor market right now, where things are going. I thought that's happened a couple times now, which to me is a little bit of an indicator in terms of the psychology in the employee base right now.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like, I don't know, this is probably not a good analogy, but it's almost like that second home that you don't use that much. And you haven't, whatever, your kids are of driving age and they haven't really been using it. All of a sudden, oh, wait, I was going to use, you know, actually I was about to use that next week or something like that. But yeah, it's, I think that's like, we had one conversation with a large, you know, Fortune 200 CEO and his leadership team. And they're talking about that. And even the concept of going to unassigned desks and what a hurdle that was to get over just psychologically for their employees, because that was always kind of viewed as like their space. And there's something psychological about that, you know, that ownership or that pride you take in having your space. So yeah, be fascinating to watch how that continues to play out.
Right. I'm going to shift back kind of the capital markets and interest rate side of things relative to the hard assets of real estate. And sure. You look in these markets where, you know, there's loans coming due. And like you said, it's unless it's a trophy asset and there's really a good story there, they're just, you know, likely going to be going back to the lenders or being repurposed. And I think it's going to change the landscapes of part of these major metropolitan areas. And it'll be interesting to see. It's happened over, you know, hundreds of years in cities, but now it's happening in the course of like 2 to 5 years, I think. But some of the numbers are kind of staggering in terms of the amount of buildings that will probably go dark, and you can't really do anything with them. So I don't know, you know, how that's going to affect the overall landscape across the country, but there's a continuation of the haves and the have-nots within the city landscape. And I think, you know, it's interesting to think about, you know, how you're going to have, you know, the populations kind of go to one part of the city, and then it's going to drive the values up. And then maybe it just needs to play out and see what happens to, you know, for example, Chicago, the Central Loop. Maybe it has to go dark in order for it to get revitalized. I don't know.
Yeah, I was just listening to a gentleman from Indeed, I think it was like their chief economist or something, talking about like what the implications have been of remote work on urban cores. And the punchline there is like kind of the de-densification of cities. And so if you think about like the, you know, you've got the remote work and basically I'll call it that lack of required proximity to that urban core. And then at the same time, you've got costs of capital is increasing for a lot of these buildings that already are having this vacancy. So it seems like it could be a little bit of a compound effect. And I don't, you know, I know people are talking about it, data reviews, but, you know, I'm not definitely not an expert in that area. And what I've heard is it's quite expensive. So it will be fascinating to see, but it is definitely not a, it is not a unique problem, right? That the urban cores, and I think, you know, Chicago, you know, where you sit is going to be right in the heart of that based on some of the conversations that I've heard.
Yeah. And what about the housing market? You know, the renters versus the owners, obviously the interest rates going up is affecting the housing market dramatically. We talked a little bit about some of the rising median home prices, but how is, you know, owning versus leasing going to affect, you know, from a geography standpoint, as well as just demographically, you know, where do you see things playing out?
Yeah, well, the spread, and we've seen this across, like, call it like wages for software developers, even like over the last couple of years, the spread between the most affordable of the top 30 metros and the most expensive, that's condensed by about 20%. So the premise there being is like, hey, the market's kind of getting more efficient with more and more people working remotely. And you're seeing that same thing play out with the cost of housing, right? The most affordable cities that had the highest quality of life, those markets are disproportionately getting more expensive. And so, and you pair that on top of the, you know, the migration trend, which everybody knows, you know, kind of the smile states and the coast, better climate, along with the aging boomers, right, who are now retiring and saying, hey, if I'm getting older, do I really want to, you know, have to deal with these Midwest or Northeast winters anymore? So you pair all that with these, I'll call it the interest rate environment that we touched on before. I was running some numbers just looking at like, what is that median? So the median house, like sale price for a house from 15 to 20, average like 310, let's call it 330 grand. I think it was like 330 grand in Q2 of 20. Well, if you look forward, fast forward to today, I think it's around 455, the most recent numbers that I've seen. So, and then if you layer on top of that, your interest rates going from, you know, whatever, a 3% mortgage to a 7% mortgage, you know, the lack of mobility that I think that's going to create, I think it's going to really halt a lot of this migration that we've seen. Because I think if you're looking at 3% mortgage, you know, the kind of the upper limit, the upper bound people record, the kind of the standard recommendation is you don't want to spend more than 30% of your, you know, your gross income on your housing. Well, you say, okay, well, what kind of house can you afford? Or, you know, if you buy a $330,000 house, right, take the 2020 number, and you can only spend 30% of your income on that house at 3% interest, let's just simple math, you finance the entire thing, which I know isn't possible, but gives you an order of magnitude. You need to be making $55,000 a year, or your household need to be making $55,000 to be able to afford the median house in 2020. Fast forward to today, when that's at $455,000-ish and interest rates are 7%, now all of a sudden you need to be making $105,000 a year, right? So you went from, you know, if you just call the median household income roughly $70,000, it was okay, I could be making 20% below the median household income in the country and still afford the, you know, buy the median home. So, okay, homes are affordable. Fast forward to today, you know, again, that median household income hasn't changed a lot. Call it 70, 75 grand. And you need to be making whatever, 30% more than the median household income to be able to afford the median home. So pair that dynamic with the rising interest rates and saying, hey, do I really want to trade out of my 2% mortgage into a 7% mortgage in one of these markets that, yeah, it's a higher quality of life, but the pricing has gone up 60% in the last 2 years in those markets, even relative to the, you know, to the way that the largest metros have grown. And I think that's going to slow down some of these. That plus, you know, we've, like, as we talked about last time, we're kind of moving through the, you know, the peak of the millennials and kind of them hitting that child rearing age. And you're starting to see some of that show up in the numbers regarding this, like, second kind of bit, you know, there was the talk of, hey, there's been, you know, this lack of a baby boom, or everybody stopped having kids during COVID. And then, oh, wait, now there's this baby boom that has come, you know, a bit later from the, you know, the peak of the millennial cohort now starting to have kids. So I think, you know, it'll be interesting to see, but I think some of that trend is definitely going to slow. I mean, I expect it to continue, but slow.
Yeah. I mean, renting gives you all the flexibility you want, right? And typically, I mean, when you're in your early 20s, you want to have flexibility across the board. You really don't start thinking about settling down in a market or somewhere until you're starting a family and starting a life in that next chapter in your life. There was a lot of people that moved out of certain markets. At one point, I know you were down in Tampa, maybe still are sometimes.
Yep.
That gave you all the flexibility. But at some point, you want to, you know, set your roots somewhere.
Yep.
And I think the winners are going to be, you know, the lower tax states continuously.
No doubt.
But we're already seeing, you know, cracks in the armor in Florida, for example. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see where the rents go. You still have a lot of people down there, but, you know, the insurance premiums have gone up 30%. You've yep. got a lot of issues with a lot of climate change things. And maybe it's not as great of a place to be. And you can go to a lower cost. I'm not saying, you know, people are going to be moving back up north or anything.
Yeah.
But I had Sean Dragas, who's our head of ESG for Colliers, on recently. And, you know, if you look at a 100-year bet, it actually is around the Great Lakes state. That's where you want to invest, because from a climate perspective, that's where companies are looking at really lower volatility and lower risk for investments totally. Ongoing. But in the short term, I just think in the short term, with the labor market going where it's going, unemployment potentially going up, I think there will be some people moving back to certain markets that maybe from whence they came and maybe setting some roots moving forward.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, look at it. If you're talking super macro, I'll call it political, you'll call it capital markets, you know, or economic, you know, what's the state of the interest, you know, interest rates and your cost of capital, demographics, and then, you know, and environmental. I think those are four of the variables that you certainly have to keep an eye on. And that's certainly four of the probably the top variables that a lot of our, you know, clients one way or another are discussing when they're thinking about where they want to locate, right? Talk about another of these, you know, market, you know, I mean, I think Maricopa County, what has been the fastest growing county in the country, I think 5 out of the last 6 years or something. Well, now we're hearing a lot of, I'll call it a lot of this manufacturing projects that were coming, you know, onshoring, but a lot of them require a lot of water. Well, you know, you've seen all the challenges there. So I think that's definitely a consideration. And another interesting point that I think is underappreciated is that, you know, over the last 15 years, right, I would say that the high barrier to entry, like the markets that were challenging to bring supply online, have been the growth markets, right? People were moving into cities, people were moving into the, you know, the New York, the LAs, even the Austins, right? Where there's high supply barriers. So essentially that's going to disproportionately increase pricing. And now as you see people going to some of these more quality, higher quality of life, lower cost, lower tax states, there actually is ability to provide more supply. So that actually should be a deflationary, theoretically a deflationary variable there. But yeah, I mean, I think the weather risk, you know, I've had friends personally who have been in Florida and have been kind of, you know, either, you know, between a couple of the recent hurricanes, either hit directly or had some close calls. And it certainly has, I think, changed some of the calculus, at least in their minds, regarding, you know, how long-term of a location that is for them.
Yeah. So Brett, you're in front of a lot of clients talking about labor analytics. What has the conversation changed? Have you seen any shift in the conversation in the last, you know, 3-4 months? Any discernible difference? Or are clients still asking the same questions?
Good question. I would say like my macro themes is diversity continues to be a really critical piece of the equation that I think was underplayed probably 2-3 years ago regarding how they think about what is the right place for them to grow a diverse workforce. Political environment is another one that, you know, I think with some of the actions that have been taking place at, you know, at the Supreme Court level, the states now probably have more legislative power than they've had in the last 100 years. So consequently, where you live is going to have more of an impact on your, call it your core rights, than, you know, again, anytime and certainly in my lifetime. So I think that's an important consideration. And you know, and I'll call it the proliferation of like social media, I think is pushing some of those variables, kind of keeping them, you know, more top of mind. The other one I would say is that like this, think about this quality versus cost trade-off. I think the math on that is starting to shift a little bit, where it was, again, if you're a growth-based company, it's like, hey, I want the best people. I don't really care what I have to pay for them. I just want the best talent at all costs. Well, that did cost a lot. Well, now, again, back to the beginning of our conversation where your cost of capital is a lot higher, you need to hit profitability sooner. It's like, I'm really looking for value in probably a different way than I was, you know, even 12 months ago.
Right. I haven't seen the quality as far as the real estate goes, continues to be a big driver, right? People are willing to pay up for quality. And that's pretty much been for the attraction component. So just like back in the day when, you know, the CFOs were asking for more dense space, so because it was an economic decision, we may get back to that. I don't see that. I don't see us going back to that kind of density from a cost reduction standpoint. But there's got to be a happy medium where you're not necessarily just getting the Taj Mahal and hoping that people will come. But like you said, there's a metric that defines what that value is going to be, and value might come into play again. So,
yeah, totally. And I don't want that point to be overstated though, because I mean, certainly quality, like, you know, I'd say that human capital is going to continue to be the key to the value equation for organizations going forward. And as we do, you know, enter these times of historically, you know, unprecedented volatility, the best human capital and the most agile organizations are going to, you know, I think there's a massive opportunity for a lot of organizations right now. There's going to be greater variability between the not top 90% and the mean. And whether that's you're a software company or you're a real estate brokerage company, I think that narrative is going to continue to remain true because the environment is changing, the access to information is changing, and the organizations who are best able to, you know, to sift through the noise, identify those variables that matter, use that information to make strategic positions and see around corners. I think those are the organizations who are going to come out of this, you know, stronger than they went into it.
Yeah, always. All right. Well, let's end on that high note. Thanks for your time. Always appreciate it.
Awesome. Appreciate you, Dougal.
writing you a letter. They say it's for the better. Who could ever reach you? Or was it me that couldn't see through? No one ever taught us. Is this why I won't repeat? Is this why I won't repeat? Is this why I won't repeat? I just wanna know when it's time to let this go.
Research and show, and no time to go.
I can never teach you. Should go home, it's late, but I'm out of doing something.
Looking for the sound, one life, one love.
Maybe it's about time.